its government, parliament, and even army allowed to continue existing. Among the occupied territories, the army's presence was strongest in France and Belgium, for it occupied both countries under the auspices of full military government. A major reason for this was that from the moment the Germans conquered them, France and Belgium became not just important sources of economic wealth for the Reich, but also its western military frontier. In 1940 and 1941, this was a frontier on the offensive. France and Belgium provided bases from which the Luftwaffe and Kriegsmarine conducted operations against Britain. Norway and the Netherlands also belonged to this frontier, but although the army occupied them, it did not govern them. Instead, Hitler put a civilian Reich commissioner in charge of each, for such was the Germanic character of their populations that Hitler did not want their future in the hands of an army whose commitment to Nazi ideology he still considered less than wholesale. This says much not only about Hitler, but also about elements of the army. The officers who governed France and Belgium were generally somewhat older and more conservative, and less admiring of National Socialism than many of their frontline colleagues. A number were also Francophile in their outlook. They harbored unmistakable anti-communist and anti-Semitic views, and their administration of France and Belgium was not a benign one. It occupied, exploited, and oppressed both countries in the service of the Reich. It also became deeply implicated in the deportation and murder of Jews from French and Belgian territory. But there were several ways in which the military governments administered their territories in a relatively measured, discriminating manner, if less for moral reasons than for the practical one of seeking relatively peaceable, manageable relations with the occupied population. Overall, while any impression of a gentlemanly occupation should be firmly resisted by the listener, so too should any assumption that the bulk of either country's population suffered anything approaching the levels of terror and rapacity to which Poland and several other occupied territories were subjected. In France and Belgium, then, the army not only played a particularly central role in occupation, but also acted with more moderation than elsewhere. Given the centrality of the army's role within them, this chapter, like later chapters also examining the German occupation of northwest Europe, focuses primarily on the German army's occupation of Belgium, and above all, by virtue of its greater size and the larger literature concerning it, of France. A militaire Befehlshaber, military governor, with his headquarters in Paris, was made responsible for the bulk of German-occupied northern France, together with the English-speaking Channel Islands. For a fortnight in June 1940, General Blaskowitz held the post, before making way for General Alfred Stretzius. General of Infantry Otto von Stülpnagel, the first commander to hold the governorship for any duration, took over in October. The northernmost industrialized part of the country was separated from the rest of German-occupied France. This region was the responsibility of the military governor in Brussels, General of Infantry Alexander von Falkenhausen, as were Belgium and, temporarily, Luxembourg. Within France, the Vichy government, despite its nominal independence, was required to prevent economic assets from leaving France and to bear the financial costs of German occupation. The military government in Paris contained a military administration staff with a section overseeing the Vichy government and ensuring it acted according to German wishes. As well as being responsible for military matters within their territories, military governors exercised power over the economic and administrative life of the occupied population. Both military governors were directly answerable to the commander-in-chief of the army, Field Marshal von Brauchitsch. Generally, the administrative structure of each of the military governments was divided into various levels of Kommandanturen, regional and local headquarters, the most important of which was the regional Feldkommandantur, field headquarters. In France, there was also an intermediate level of administration, the Chef des Militärverwaltungsbezirks, Chief of Military Administration District. Until 1942, the jurisdictions at this intermediate level were named A, B, C, and Bordeaux. The German army did not embrace its occupation responsibilities enthusiastically, but its occupation officials often fancied themselves more efficient than civilian administrators. After us, the rabble, army administrators in Luxembourg were heard to remark, after Hitler transferred the country from military to civilian authority in September 1940, Within the military government in Paris, there was tension between Colonel Hans Speidel's command staff, which comprised proper army officers, and the military administration staff's government subsection. This subsection mainly comprised civil servants who had received an equivalent army rank and been put into uniform. Its chief, Werner Becht, was a lawyer by profession. He also held the rank of Brigadeführer in the SS. Egert Rede, the head of military administration in the military government of Belgium and northern France, was likewise a lawyer who held honorary SS rank. Despite their SS membership, pragmatism rather than ideology tended to govern their actions, even though, particularly in Becht's case, the two traits merged together in a ruthlessly calculating mind. When it came to running the occupation, military governors were assisted in internal policing by the Wehrmacht's own secret field police, Geheime Feldpolizei, or GFP. The GFP was under overall command of the Chief of Army Police within the OKH, Wilhelm Kirschbaum. It investigated resistance, real or potential, across occupied Europe. Its duties included detecting enemy agents, collecting inflammatory material, taking precautionary measures against sabotage and interrogating suspects. Although the GFP was officially a Wehrmacht organization, its personnel had been transferred from the Gestapo, and Kirschbaum himself was a member of the SS. But over time, as resistance to the occupation grew, the military governors increasingly came to rely upon the SS and police itself to investigate resistance and to provide additional manpower for internal security. The military government in Paris also had to reckon with the machinations of Otto Abetz, the German Foreign Ministry's representative. Military governors were also responsible for economic policy within their territories, a duty they exercised through the economic subsection of their military administration sections. But they often clashed with officials from central economic agencies, particularly Göring's Office of the Four-Year Plan. Such clashes usually ensued because the military governor on one side and central economic agencies on the other had conflicting agendas. Both sides were out to exploit the occupied territories, and how far the population consequently suffered was of secondary concern. But the military governor's approach was less indiscriminately acquisitive than Göring's. Particularly during the occupation's early years, they were concerned most specifically with the economic needs of the military in the occupied territories. Even here, the military governors sought to keep the population quiescent and maintain their territory's long-term viability by ensuring that those territories were not exploited any more than necessary. The military government conveyed this approach in a letter to General Jodl, which declared, "One must give a cow fodder in order to get milk." But for Göring's men, the primary economic aims were to meet the central needs of Germany's war economy and to keep its civilian population satisfied. As the war continued, they stood increasingly ready to exploit occupied territory to the hilt in order to meet these objectives. Military governors answerable to the OKH could also fall foul of contradictory directives from the OKW and clash with field commanders of any branch of the Wehrmacht whose forces were stationed in their territory. One of the greatest bones of contention between military governors and field commanders was unrestrained plunder. Military governors were more concerned than field commanders about keeping the population pacified, while field commanders had fewer qualms about seizing supplies from occupied civilians if they felt their own men needed them. It did not help that military governors, like German army generals more widely, were not political animals. They lacked the close contact with the Nazi political leadership enjoyed by their counterparts in the SS and police and in the Reich's economic agencies. Furthermore, such was their pragmatic view that occupation administration was simply a job that needed doing, they lacked the ambition that animated many senior civilian administrators and that might have led them to push their own agenda more forcefully. Moreover, military governors lacked a vocal champion in the OKH, someone who might have had Hitler's ear. Field Marshal von Brauchitsch was not assertive enough, General Quartermaster Wagner was not senior enough, and General Halder, focused as he was on military operations, could hardly be bothered. Nor did military administrations command huge numbers of German personnel. For instance, at the beginning of November 1942, there were only 15,000 officers, NCOs and men active in military administration headquarters across the whole of occupied France. Military administrations therefore tried to maintain a minimal supervisory presence, relying primarily upon large cooperative native administrations. However, the enthusiasm these administrations felt for the Nazi New Order varied, and none of them matched that of Vidkun Quisling's quasi-Nazi administration in Norway. More often, collaborationist native administrators were motivated by calculating opportunism, or, more usually still, because they grudgingly recognized that cooperating with the Germans was the best way to preserve a tolerable wartime existence for the majority of their people. The army-supervised indigenous administration in Belgium harbored all three motives to some extent. General von Falkenhausen was not a straightforward old-school conservative, but a well-educated, well-traveled individual who had even flirted with Buddhism. He did not always observe the highest moral standards. His role in the fate of Belgium's Jews would demonstrate that. But he was a private critic of the Nazi regime and eventually would become involved in the anti-Nazi military resistance. He was also sensible enough to seek tranquil conditions for the military government by treating both the Belgian administration and the bulk of the Belgian population fairly leniently. Many Belgians would have felt relieved at this, given the ravages to which the Kaiser's army had subjected their country during the First World War. Indeed, with the major exception of the country's Jews, most Belgian civilians would have viewed the German occupation of the Second World War as being preferable to that of the First. Reda, in particular, was interested not just in occupying Belgium, but also in transforming its economic and political structure into that of a corporatist, technocratic state. His main motive was political. Knowing Hitler was lukewarm to the idea of prolonging the life of the military government, Reda believed he was much more likely to preserve it if it could show itself to be proactive and dynamic. For instance, in August 1940, the military government arranged the Belgian agricultural sector into a combined organization called the Foodstuffs and Agricultural Union. Although this particular endeavor was only partially successful, many Belgians from across the political spectrum liked the idea of root-and-branch reform of their country's political and economic structures, for during the interwar years they had lost much of their faith in parliamentary democracy. The military government had little trouble co-opting much of the Belgian establishment, including civil servants, industrialists, and the church. It augmented its influence through extensive media censorship and press ownership. Lance Corporal Alfred M. of the 35th Infantry Division, writing in his diary in August 1940, described the Walloons as filthy, work-shy, deceitful and perfidious, shifty and pernicious, but the Flemings as clean and industrious, friendly and open, hearty and good-natured. It is unclear how widely German occupation troops in Belgium harbored such views, but at policy level, while Hitler empowered the military government to run the country to Germany's maximum economic benefit with the minimum German military commitment, he also consciously favored the Flemings, whom he considered a lost Germanic tribe. The military government's favored Flemish collaborating partner was the mainstream political party, the Vlaams Nationaal Verbond, Flemish National Union, or VNV. It had far less time for the Walloon fascist Rex movement of Léon Degrelle. The Rexists were not to the taste of conservative-minded military administrators, and Reda scorned them as disruptive extremists. On the whole, the indigenous Belgian administration itself hoped above all simply to carry out its day-to-day functions with minimal German interference. The case of occupied France, which until November 1942 comprised the northern half of the country, provides the greatest opportunity to observe the nuanced relationship between occupier and occupied as it played out on the ground. Here, as in Belgium, during the first 2 years of occupation, the demands of the German war economy and the damage they wrought upon the occupier-occupied relations were markedly less severe than they would later become. Relations between occupier and occupied were therefore characterized by considerable give and take. French administrative officials in German-occupied France could not communicate directly with the Vichy government, and thus needed to invoke the authority of the German occupiers in order to get anything done. but the Germans needed the French authorities to ensure that the population adhered to the rules, regulations, and requirements of the occupation. The Feldkommandantur in Nantes, for instance, informed the local French authorities that passive resistance, acts of violence, sabotage, or work stoppage must be prevented with the utmost rigor, and the guilty parties arrested and punished. The crimes it subjected to martial law included 1. Assistance given to non-German soldiers in occupied territory, 2. Transmission of information to detriment of the German army and Reich, 3. Assistance to French POWs, 4. Offences against the German army and its commanders, together with street gatherings, distribution of leaflets, public meetings and demonstrations, and any other active hostility to Germany. These were all standard obligations for an indigenous administration under occupation, laid down in the 1907 Hague Convention and incorporated into the terms of the 1940 armistice. As long as the French accepted defeat and acted obediently, the German authorities assured them of the sanctity of their lives, property, and religion. Yet where there was a conflict of interests, the French would soon find that those of the occupier took precedence. This would become increasingly clear as time went by. But even in the early days of occupation, the process of give-and-take was often a tense one. Thus, in the words of Robert Gildea, as well as declarations of cordiality, there were veritable wars of nerves, feinting and fencing, threats and blandishments, bluff and counter-bluff, claims to more power or resources than were actually to hand. But the age and outlook of numerous German military administrators helped ease the process. Though France's military reputation had taken a drubbing during the 1940 campaign, many military administrators were old enough to hold personal memories of the 1914 to 1918 war and of France's valiant efforts during the course of it. With the degree of respect they thus afforded the French people came a broader perspective on the country more generally. The personality of a German occupation administrator and his relationship with French civilian officials played a major role in shaping the occupation regime in a particular locality. In the Angers region in northwest France, for example, the relatively amiable Feldkommandant Colonel Kloss was well received by French officials following his harsh and abrasive predecessor, Captain Marlow. West of Angers, the coastal port of Nantes benefited from having Lieutenant Colonel Karl Hotz as its Feldkommandant. Hotz spoke fluent French, had worked in Nantes during the early 1930s, and was described by a local interpreter as an old man, dry, short, dressed in artillery officer's uniform, with a broad smile and kindly expression. Soldiers stationed in France expressed mixed views about the country. The inhabitants look wretched, the houses look dirty, and the public amenities are built haphazardly, wrote Lance Corporal Arnold N. of the 96th Infantry Division, a fifth wave formation in July 1940. Lance Corporal Alfred M. was even more graphic, a diary entry of early August recounting, "What's presented before our eyes here in northern France is beyond poverty. Words like squalor and neglect can't convey it." On the other hand, German occupation troops stationed in many parts of France enjoyed perhaps the most comfortable existence of any German occupier. Not all appreciated it. Captain Paul K., serving on patrol duty in Paris, wrote, "The French bars are unwelcoming, and the famous pleasure palaces with their cabaret, etc., are ridiculously expensive." But Arnold N., who was transferred from the 96th Infantry Division to serve on the staff of the military government in Paris, became one of the many German soldiers more thankful to serve in France, as he made clear writing from his office in June 1941. "Barely 300 metres, 330 yards, from the Arc de Triomphe, I spend my days in a wonderful building with carpet-bedecked corridors, staircases, paintings, and mirrors everywhere throwing back the movements of soldiers and officers carrying files around. As for the city itself, the charm of Paris is difficult to deny," wrote another soldier posted to the city. "It bewitches even those least sensitive to it." Others still used a posting in Paris as an opportunity to live it up. Hans von Luck had commanded Rommel's reconnaissance battalion during the French campaign and spent several weeks in Paris following the armistice. He later recalled his embarrassment when drunken members of the military administration sang Nazi songs in the bars, while the French customers would have liked to hear chansons. Once, when it became too much for me and physical violence threatened to break out, I called the military police and had the place cleared of rowdy Germans. There was plenty of hedonism to be had in the provinces, too. For instance, drunken brawls were widespread in the Loire region. After one particularly heavy night in September 1941, two German soldiers were injured, prompting investigations by both the German and French police. Incidents often happen in these places, the French police commissioner observed, because of the mingling of males and females, and above all, because of the abuse of alcohol. An altogether more genteel appreciation of French hospitality was displayed by Hans Albring, who spent his free time in Poitiers visiting local churches, then celebrating his promotion to sergeant by visiting Rouen and striking up a good relationship with a bookseller who sold him several rare books with valuable woodcuts. But between German soldiers and French civilians having to come to terms with their country's defeat, relations were not generally cordial. Where troops were stationed played an important role here. In thinly populated rural areas, it was possible to put names to faces and break down barriers somewhat. The Breton novelist Louis Guillou provided several examples, as Julian Jackson recounts. The French policeman raises his hat in greeting to the German policeman standing on the step. A friend whom Guillou visits is giving a young German officer a French lesson, which is interrupted for a friendly argument about the outcome of the war. A beach in July is so crowded with swimmers that it is impossible to distinguish French swimmers from German ones. French children know which Germans are likely to be a soft touch for sweets. But cities provided few such opportunities. Paris, for instance, might be replete with fleshpots, art and culture, but it was also a vast impersonal posting in which to be stationed, where French citizens regarded their occupiers frostily or sought to ignore them altogether. Thus did Jean-Paul Sartre describe his experience of travelling on the Paris metro. At the start, the sight of the Germans was offensive to us, and then, little by little, we learnt not to notice them. They were more like the furniture than they were like men. And as early as 1940, the French were already being reminded that, relatively restrained though the military government's policies might be, they remained a vanquished people vulnerable to the oppression and avarice of their occupiers. As yet, the reminders were small, but noticeable nonetheless. Among the petty regulations the Germans brought in, people were fined for not crossing the road at the proper point, cyclists were stopped for riding three abreast, and pedestrians had to step off pavements to let Germans pass. Suffering serial minor humiliations on a daily basis, it is little wonder that many French civilians failed to appreciate the generally correct behaviour of German soldiers. An August 1940 German army report on public opinion in three départements noted that the exemplary, amiable, and helpful behaviour of the German soldiers towards the population has aroused little sympathy. Two contexts which, however nuanced, regularly saw German conduct cross over into exploitation territory were sex and shopping. The occupation's early months saw a mushrooming of sexual encounters between occupier and occupied. France, after all, was a country from which 1.5 million Frenchmen had just been removed as fatalities, casualties, and most numerously prisoners of war, and in which German soldiers now strutted around with ready cash and the glow of victors. Encounters ran the spectrum from rape cases to courtly wooing, with all variations sordid or otherwise in between. It is unsurprising that, in the words of Robert Gilder, it has been calculated that Germans did their bit to tackle France's demographic deficit by fathering between 50,000 and 70,000 children. Field Marshal von Brauchitsch called for units stationed in the West to keep their troops occupied with sports, including team games, athletics, and swimming. Yet he also perceived that the troops needed a necessary outlet for their sexual energies. And to this end, the military government in Paris authorized a series of Wehrmacht-run brothels. The military government did not order the press ganging of women and girls from the general population, something German commands would habitually go on to do in the occupied Soviet Union, but it did use other forms of coercion, dragooning women and girls who were already prostitutes, regardless of whether or not they wished to work independently. Herein lay a second motive for establishing Wehrmacht-run brothels. The military government believed they were a means of stamping out unregulated prostitution, and with it sexually transmitted diseases, concerns the Vichy authorities also shared. Soldiers were acutely aware of the risks, too. "Every second house is a café bar, and there's a knocking shop above every one of them," wrote Georg Damel to his sister. "The girls here are lovely in face and figure, but they're unbelievably perfumed and made up, and a lot of them have got the clap, according to our doctor." Private Willy P. of the 167th Infantry Division wrote in July 1940, "Today it was announced at roll call that we, master soldiers, are forbidden to go walking or hanging out with the French fräuleins." 3 months later, after being promoted to Lance Corporal, he was aghast. "Yesterday the first woman from here arrived in hospital with a venereal disease. Three of our soldiers, too. What's striking is the different ways in which this topic is discussed. When you listen to civilians, the story is that we infected them. Though among ourselves, of course, it's the opposite story." The Sanitätsdienst, Sanitation Office, the Wehrmacht's central health and medical body, also firmly believed that controlled brothels would prevent the troops from catching STDs. Anti-Semitic prejudice played a role too, if a secondary one, for Nazi propaganda depicted pimps as Jews, as well as linking prostitution to crime. The military government combined its policy of regulated brothels with a crackdown on unregulated prostitution, ordering the internment of unregistered prostitutes and raids on dockside bars in major ports. When it came to shopping, the larger French cities, above all Paris, proved a paradise for German soldiers from the occupation's earliest days. Alois Scheuer recounted to his wife a 4-day trip to Paris, which I just returned from safe and sound. "It was a wonderful trip. Paris really is a one-off. I spent a fortune, but saw and bought all sorts for it. I hope you'll like what I've got you." Scheuer was writing in June 1942, but borderline shopaholic German soldiers were swarming through French high streets as early as the summer of 1940. It was then, shortly after hostilities ended, that German soldiers in France were given leave to purchase goods on credit. In the colossal spending spree that followed, they stripped shops of most of their consumer goods. Their appetite for clothes, which they packed off to wives and girlfriends in Germany, was particularly prodigious. Parisians nicknamed them potato beetles. In Nantes, after the city's department stores had been ransacked, the prefect described how the Germans had taken radios, refrigerators, champagne, flowers, expensive antique or modern furniture, carpets, drapes, luxurious dinner services, watches, chandeliers, bicycles, cars, and even pleasure boats. Belgium experienced something similar. A joke going the rounds there in 1941 went, "Two Englishmen dressed as German officers were arrested in Belgium as spies. The Germans did not pick them out, but the Belgians did, because they were not carrying suitcases." The soldiers' consumer binge did have one benign, if short-lived, economic effect. It temporarily preempted the deflation that often afflicts post-conflict economies. But the long-term effect, save in Scandinavia, where the military authorities restricted their troops' spending power, was to drive up inflation to dangerous levels. And this was only the uncontrolled aspect of an enormous requisitioning program that the Germans, finally able to ease the shortages that had plagued their own economy during the 1930s, now unleashed upon occupied Europe. In Western Europe, the occupiers were nominally constrained by the Hague Convention, which forbade the seizure of private property unless it was militarily necessary. But Field Marshal von Brauchitsch made sure to employ a wide definition of military necessity, confiscating raw materials and semi-finished and finished goods of military importance. From the outset of the occupation, the agency that carried out the most forensic, wide-ranging exploitation of the French economy was the Central Purchasing Office, headed by General of Infantry Georg Thomas. This was a hybrid civilian-military grouping, comprising personnel from the three armed services, the Office of the Four-Year Plan, and Todt's Munitions Ministry. Initially, Göring himself had the power to arbitrate in disputes between the Central Purchasing Office and the military government in Paris. By late 1940, the military government of Belgium and northern France at least perceived that wildly seizing raw materials threatened law and order, as well as economic order, because it fueled unemployment and, with it, social resentment. It also sought to ensure sufficient food supplies for the working portion of the population at least, reasoning that it made no sense to bleed them white, as has at times been proposed. Among other things, the Germans needed to consider the impact the British naval blockade was having upon the populations and economies of occupied Europe, and, by extension, upon how far the occupiers could exploit them. The Germans also imposed shortages across occupied Western Europe with clearing agreements. These arrangements compelled occupied countries to divert huge amounts of their exports to Germany, with the empty promise that they would be paid for at a later date. The Germans also confiscated or bought up huge reserves of raw materials. Given the immediate capitulation of Denmark, the almost immediate capitulation of the Netherlands, and the favoured racial status of the two peoples, the Nazi leadership was inclined, for now, to allow them relatively privileged economic conditions. For instance, while the Germans had extracted 2,700 tons of metals from the Netherlands by the end of 1940, they had extracted 9,500 from Belgium. It is worth mentioning that the Norwegians, despite their supposed racial similarities to the Danes and the Dutch, were hit much harder than either, for the Norwegians had had the temerity to resist the German invasion for several weeks, and Goering was eager to exploit Norway for its mining, smelting, shipyards, hydroelectricity, and chemicals. Meanwhile, the Wehrmacht itself imposed immense demands for construction materials earmarked for defences, naval bases, and other military installations along the Norwegian coast. The shortages that resulted from all this, as well as from soldiers' uncontrolled private spending, inevitably drove up inflation. So too did the Germans demand that all occupied territories, save Denmark, pay for the costs of occupation themselves. In Belgium, the military government issued loans, treasury bonds, and new banknotes to meet the monthly occupation costs. The French occupation zone was forced to make daily instalment payments of 20 million Reichsmarks, as well as 10 million each day for quartering the German troops. Inflation resulted because the Germans paid for the costs by taking over occupied territories' banks and using them to print more money. In turn, inflation fueled a thriving black market. The latter flourished not just because of wartime shortages, but also because the Germans had introduced price controls. Furthermore, German soldiers themselves were often among the black market's best customers. Military authorities in the affected parts of Europe invoked harsh punishments against black marketeers, but this was the height of hypocrisy, for they were in on the act. The military authorities, together with the SS, the Abwehr, Wehrmacht Intelligence Service, and the German and indigenous civilian authorities, all ran black market firms themselves. They did so partly because infiltrating the black market made it easier to investigate it, but also for the more venal motive of buying up as many available goods and raw materials as possible. Nor did they have qualms about colluding with criminal elements in the process, though the military authorities at least eventually cleaned up their act on this front. Yet it was partly because economic conditions did not nosedive straight away that resistance to the German occupation was slow to develop. There were many further reasons for this. Denmark and Norway lacked any tradition of resistance to foreign occupiers. France and Belgium did possess such a tradition, but their societies were more urbanized and their populations too concentrated for a large-scale guerrilla campaign of the kind that partisans in occupied southern and eastern Europe would wage during the Second World War. But the most fundamental reason why resistance did not emerge on any great scale during 1940 and 1941 was also the most mundane. Most occupied civilians, while not actively collaborating with the Germans, elected to accept the tolerable if austere conditions of occupation and adopt an attitude of attentisme, wait and see. Nevertheless, there was visible if sporadic resentment of German occupation from its earliest months, and embryonic resistance across all of occupied Western Europe save Denmark. In Belgium, for instance, Germany's failure to invade Britain and Italian defeats in Southeast Europe and North Africa during the autumn of 1940 led many civilians to realize that the war was far from over. Generally, however, Western European resistance groups recognized that full-scale uprisings were out of the question. They lacked numbers, organization, and equipment, not least because the British were as yet in no position to support, coordinate, and supply them effectively. European resistance movements aimed instead to build secret armies that would eventually be activated shortly before invasion by liberating Allied troops. Thus would they be able to participate in liberation while sparing their compatriots the misery of harsh German reprisals. Meanwhile, resistance groups would carry out covert activities such as producing clandestine newspapers and propaganda, providing escape routes for fugitive Allied servicemen, and sabotaging German supply and communication lines. If they felt particularly daring, they would launch individual strikes and assassination attempts on German and collaborationist personnel. The German army itself seriously contemplated the danger of at least low-level resistance as early as the winter of 1940 to 1941, when Field Marshal von Brauchitsch's office declared, "The situation of the population in the occupied Western territories may become harder in the course of the winter months. Local unrest cannot be ruled out. In the first instance, it is the job of the military administration to observe these developments sharply." In July 1940, Churchill sought some means of hitting back at the Germans in mainland Europe following the British Army's recent forcible ejection from it. He accordingly set up Britain's Special Operations Executive, SOE, with instructions to, in his famous phrase, set Europe ablaze by supporting resistance and subversion throughout the occupied lands. Yet despite Churchill's hopes and the Germans' fears, there was little real resistance or subversion to support between the summers of 1940 and 1941. Nor, therefore, was there yet any need for the German occupiers to respond to resistance with a hard line. A measure of the leniency with which the military government in Paris conducted itself was an incident that took place in October 1940, in which three members of the SS Police Division, then stationed in France, carried out a black flag operation. They deliberately cut a cable in several places and tried to make it look like the work of the resistance, hoping, in vain as it turned out, to provoke the army authorities into retaliating harshly against the population. That the military government in Brussels also took a relatively low-key approach to resistance was clear in a report that Raeder issued in April 1941, when he commented, "The military administration has tried not to provoke the heroism of the masses." The military government even stopped short of preventing people from listening to the BBC by confiscating their radios, so concerned was it about looking too provocative. It did threaten the death penalty for offences including sabotage, espionage, and unauthorised possession of firearms, but this was intended as a deterrent and proved an effective one at that. Generally, such acts of resistance, whether real or perceived, as did take place, were sporadic, largely ineffective, and sometimes tragicomic. In August and September 1940 in Bordeaux, for example, a gendarme was arrested for saying it was painful to have to salute these German pigs, and a sailor found slashing German posters was sentenced to 3 months in prison for sabotage. In Nantes, the 23-year-old son of a magistrate was arrested when he drew a caricature of the Führer on the wall of a café frequented by German soldiers. The Germans eventually released him when the local French authorities persuaded them to take it as a joke. Yet the Germans were not all about leniency, even at this early stage, and their response to resistance could be unpredictably harsh. On 19 June 1940, for instance, at a time before the armistice had been signed, an agricultural worker cut the telephone lines linking the German command in Rouen, in Normandy, to the local Luftwaffe airbase. He was executed. So too was a teenager found guilty of cutting telephone cables to Royan on the southwest French coast. Various types of defiance particularly incensed the German authorities in France. One was the booing of German newsreels in the cinemas. A second was public demonstrations, in which ordinary French people participated not to resist the Germans practically, but to assert their own dignity. Thus, for example, the Germans brutishly met a demonstration on Remembrance Day, 1940, with stun grenades, fixed bayonets, and shots fired into the air. A third was strikes. A particularly large-scale strike broke out in Calais in May 1941 in response to German efforts to extract more coal from the area. The Germans reacted by arresting strikers en masse, closing down cafes, restaurants, and cinemas, and banning the sale of alcohol and tobacco. When these measures too failed, partly due to the reluctance of local gendarmes to enforce them, the Germans eventually broke the strike by withholding food and wages from the strikers. The Vichy regime eventually granted the strikers concessions, but 270 were deported to the Reich, half of whom eventually died there. Finally, there was the widespread clandestine tuning in to the radio programs of the BBC, which French people viewed not just as the voice of freedom, but also as a source of quality entertainment. Hence, a joke that was going the rounds in French Jewish circles by the autumn of 1942. Do you know what happened recently? 9:20 p.m. and you killed a German soldier, cut him open and ate his heart. Impossible. For three reasons. The German has no heart, the Jew eats no pork, and 9:20 p.m. everyone is listening to the BBC. Well might Jews have particular cause to fear the German occupation, of course, and from its earliest days. In the Belgian port of Antwerp in July 1940, for instance, the deputy police commissioner recounted reports from Jews that they had been beaten up in the marketplace by German soldiers. We were stepped on, beaten up, mishandled, pulled by our beards, and when we were threatened with a revolver, we had to flee the marketplace. Yet even this kind of thuggery was a trifle compared with the systematically murderous fate that would eventually befall many of the Jews of France and Belgium. Overall, however, the military government in Brussels did not persecute Jews with particular alacrity during the first year of occupation. Raeder and Falkenhausen were certainly anti-Semitic, but particularly in Falkenhausen's case, to an extent that fell short of Nazi standards. They therefore did not initially consider implementing anti-Semitic measures to be a particular priority. The military government in Paris, however, saw things differently, even though Otto von Stülpnagel was no anti-Semitic ideologue himself. During the autumn of 1940, the military government in Paris began discriminating against Jews in a way that the military government in Brussels did not. An immediate wellspring for this was the Madagascar Plan. The French island colony of Madagascar seemed to offer the prospect of a massive reservation for European Jews. Franz Rademacher, an official in the German Foreign Ministry, developed the idea for the Madagascar Plan in a memorandum of July 1940. Hitler was so taken with it that he informed Abetz at the beginning of August that he intended to evacuate all Jews from Europe after the war. By autumn, it was clear that the logistical challenges involved in the plan were colossal. Moreover, as long as the war against Britain continued and the Royal Navy dominated the high seas, the plan was a non-starter. But in the meantime, its existence had spurred Nazi agencies to expedite the Jews' persecution and eventual removal from Germany and occupied Europe. Just as hatred of Jews and the number of Jews in German-occupied territory both grew, the Nazi regime's inhibitions about disposing of them in the most conclusive way possible were beginning to diminish. In 1939, the regime had initiated a euthanasia program directed against the Reich's undesirable disabled. Unusually, there was a public outcry within Germany as news of the killings leaked out, and the Nazi leadership abandoned the program. But having sanctioned the mass murder of one particular group, it would be less of a leap to sanction it again for a larger group. It was even less of a leap considering that dumping Jews in crowded, insanitary Polish ghettos, or on an island in the Indian Ocean that could not sustainably accommodate them all, would in itself reduce their numbers anyway. A trailblazer for the persecution of Jews in France was the Einsatzstab Rosenberg, a special action staff headed by the Nazi ideological theorist Alfred Rosenberg. This agency, which began operations in France in July 1940, was ostensibly charged with repossessing property that Jews had allegedly stolen from Germany. Abetz and the military government initially feared that these measures would damage their efforts at collaboration. Then Hitler backed the Einsatzstab. Abetz, whom Hitler had personally apprised of his intention to expel the Jews from Europe, changed his tune over the repossessions and placated the French authorities by placing them on a legal footing. He saw a means of gaining further approval from Berlin by pushing for the registration of Jews and their businesses. By the start of September, Group 1, the internal government subsection of Besht's department, also saw which way the wind was blowing and argued that the military government itself could not now passively stand by over Jewish affairs in France. On 26 August 1940, Besht's administrative section issued a directive that emphasized the purported link between Jews and anti-German activity. There is the danger that the Jews, with their anti-German attitude and their multifaceted connections to the unoccupied part of France and to other countries, are carrying out anti-German espionage or anti-German activities, or are at least supporting them. A consequence of this is the presence of Jews at public disturbances, as the demonstration on 20 August in Paris showed. The directive also ordered neutralizing Jewish business people, for to allow them to remain in their positions of economic power is to endanger the German conduct of the war. Moreover, figures within the military government believed that the Vichy regime, itself keen to exploit the anti-Semitism in French society, could be brought into the process. The military government's economic chief, Dr. Elmar Michel, declared, "First, we must do what is necessary to eliminate Jews even after the occupation. More important, we cannot from our side provide sufficient manpower to deal with the great number of Jewish enterprises. These two factors oblige us to have the French authorities participate in the elimination of Jews. We thereby share responsibility with the French, and have at our disposal the French administrative apparatus." On 27 September, the military government announced measures to count the number of Jews in the occupied zone and mark out Jewish businesses. And in November, Brauchitsch instructed the military government to focus on taking over Jewish businesses. There were limits to what Stulpnagel himself was prepared to countenance. In January 1941, he informed Brauchitsch that he approved of registering Jewish businesses, but that there was no legal precedent for confiscating them. Now, however, the Vichy regime pushed the process along. In March 1941, it created a General Secretariat for Jewish Affairs, charged with proposing legislative measures against Jews, fixing dates for liquidating Jewish property, and designating trustees for the purpose. Between the liberation and the end of the war, one former military government official estimated, German and French officials together Aryanized 43% of Jewish businesses, and another 12 to 18 months would have enabled them to finish the job. The autumn of 1940 brought a further ominous portent for the Jews in France, when Brauchitsch officially lifted his ban on keeping Allgemeine SS units out of the country. Shortly after the fall of France, Himmler had covertly installed 20 SD men in Paris. The existence of this supposedly clandestine group had, however, been an open secret, and Brauchitsch now acknowledged and approved its presence. Himmler had provided the final push by claiming that the Einsatzstab Rosenberg needed the help of his men in gathering art treasures. Brauchitsch now also authorized security police and SD agents to investigate anti-German activities carried out by Jews, immigrants, communists, and church groups in the occupied zone. The security police and SD were also granted leeway not only to investigate Jews, but also to arrest them. The SS and police wasted little time in exploiting the freedom of open action that Brauchitsch had granted it. In January 1941, Obersturmbannführer Helmut Knochen, commander of the security police and SD in Paris, declared that Jews who were not of French nationality must be removed from the occupied zone. In the military government of Belgium and northern France, the SS and police similarly used the military administration's security needs as a way of wedging themselves into a position of greater power. The military government needed a contingent of the security police. Initially, this contingent only had investigative authority and had to leave the actual arrests to the GFP. But Himmler was playing a double game. He employed officers in the Brussels branch who were moderate by SS standards, but saw to it that their power became ever more unbridled as time went on. In February 1941, the GFP's powers were downgraded as the security police contingent in Belgium was granted full authority to act as a political police. Falkenhausen himself inadvertently played into Himmler's hands. In February 1941, he introduced preventive custody for local inhabitants against whom no offence could be proved, but whom the occupation authorities considered dangerous nevertheless. He tried to see to it that this method was only used selectively, but it was a tool the SS and police within his jurisdiction were themselves able to take up and eventually employ wholesale. They eventually set up a brutal detention camp for the purpose at Breendonk. The great majority of the peoples populating German-occupied Western Europe were not victimized by Nazi racial policy in the way those in the East were. Senior officers and officials within the military governments that administered France and Belgium displayed some of the more beneficent characteristics of the conservatism that characterized many of the officer corps' older members. That, or they came from the kind of professional background that gave them a relatively clear-headed view of what sustaining a viable occupation regime involved. This did not make them paragons. It did, however, give them the sense not to antagonize the population needlessly. This was good politics. It smoothed the administration of the occupied territories, and it minimized the sort of resistance that could overburden their own already stretched forces. Relations between German soldiers and occupied civilians ranged from the cool to the relatively convivial, but were smoothed to an extent by the relative francophilia of the occupiers, or, in the case of Belgium, by the relatively favored status accorded to the Flemish population. And just as both military governments treated their occupied populations with relative restraint, so too did native administrators cooperate with, and native populations largely accept, the austere but bearable realities of life under the occupation. On the other hand, there were already ways in which the army's presence harmed civilians, particularly when it came to the economic life of the occupied territories. Driving this was what the Reich and the army considered practically necessary for satisfying either their economic needs or, on a smaller scale, the sexual appetite of the troops. Thus far, the army countered such resistance as it faced with considerable restraint, if also with sometimes thuggish severity, and the overall level of resistance it faced was low. But as the German war effort's needs eventually grew more acute, so its exploitation of the Reich's occupied Western territory would grow more severe and further fuel resistance in the process. The first year of occupation in the West certainly provided no reason to overstate the moderation of the military government in Paris, at least, for it was already victimizing the Jewish population of its jurisdiction. It did so due to a mixture of the anti-Semitism of leading figures within it, such as Werner Best, and of the political calculations involved in the power play between the Vichy regime, the SS and police, the Army High Command, and the military government itself. Otto von Stülpnagel was not the main driving force behind this initiative, but neither was he the significant brake on it that he might have been. Then, in June 1941, all developments with German-occupied Western Europe were suddenly eclipsed by events in the East. Chapter 7. Planning Operation Barbarossa, 1940-1941. Destroying the Soviet Union had long been Hitler's paramount concrete foreign policy aim. There were several reasons why he chose 1941 as the year in which to attempt it. The OKH would be instrumental in drawing up not only an operational plan, but also a series of immensely ruthless directives, rightfully dubbed the criminal orders by historians, designed to shape the conduct of the troops during the campaign. A number of senior commanders voiced concerns about the operational plan and the criminal orders, but none objected fundamentally. Thus did the German army unite around an invasion plan characterized by colossal hubris and immorality. Germany invaded the Soviet Union at a time when the army was not fully ready for such a challenge. The eventual consequences would prove calamitous. Because the invasion turned out to be such a turning point in the fortunes of the German army, indeed in the fortunes of the Reich itself, it is important to consider what lay behind Hitler's decision to commence it when he did. After the fall of France, much to Hitler's frustration, Britain refused to make peace. An attempt to bludgeon her to the negotiating table by defeating her air force in the Battle of Britain came to nothing. A lack of suitable invasion craft, the mauled state of the Kriegsmarine following the Norway campaign, and the Royal Navy's domination of the English Channel all rendered a seaborne invasion impossible. For Hitler, forcing Britain to come to terms was not just desirable in itself, it would also reduce the odds in Germany's favour in a future war for global domination. Hitler expected to take on the United States at some point. When he did so, it would be better to have taken Britain out of the equation. Hitler believed that the British viewed the Soviet Union, despite the existence of the Nazi-Soviet Pact, as their only potential ally in mainland Europe. Thus, by removing the Soviet Union from the equation, he hoped to demoralize Britain into making peace. Superficial reading of the flat topography and vast size of the European Soviet Union suggested immense opportunities for the German army to execute a campaign of maneuver on a grand scale. Hitler first voiced his intention to invade the Soviet Union in a meeting of 31 July 1940, well before the climax of the Battle of Britain in September. According to General Halder's diary, Hitler declared that, with Russia smashed, Britain's last hope would be shattered. In other words, Hitler's vexation at Britain's refusal to make peace was already propelling him towards the solution that chimed most closely with his ideological goals. His resolve to finish off the Soviet Union sooner rather than later was strengthened by his conviction that there was no chance of the Soviet Union accepting German domination of Europe, and by the Reich's failure to degrade Britain by knocking away her props in the Mediterranean and Middle East. That such a peripheral strategy never seriously evolved was partly because the only service branch that advocated it was the Kriegsmarine, and partly because the Germans could not secure the necessary agreement between Mussolini's Italy, Franco's Spain, and Vichy France. There were pressing economic reasons to invade the Soviet Union. That country's grain, oil, and other resources promised a far greater economic bonanza than occupied Western Europe could provide. Moreover, though the resource base of occupied Western Europe prevented Britain's naval blockade from hurting Germany as much as it had during the First World War, the blockade did shut off Germany from world markets. It also enabled Britain to import far more in the way of raw materials than Germany could. Then there was food. While Germany could escape direct privation by seizing foodstuffs from across occupied Europe had to be able to produce such foodstuffs in the first place, and the blockade deprived French, Danish, and Dutch farmers of vital agricultural supplies. Further, there was a thin line between benefiting from the Nazi-Soviet Pact's economic provisions and being economically dependent on the Soviet Union. In December 1940, General Halder remarked in his diary, "Every weakness in the position of the Axis brings a push by the Russians. They cannot prescribe the rules of transactions, but they utilize every opportunity to weaken the Axis position." In January 1941, with Stalin anxious to keep Hitler placated, the Soviets changed their tune and doubled their deliveries. This probably additionally encouraged Hitler to invade, partly because it further demonstrated the full extent of the economic bounty a conquered Soviet Union could yield, and partly because it showed Stalin was frightened. German military intelligence's buoyant assessments of Soviet fighting power also emboldened Hitler. Unfortunately for him, he took no heed of how unreliable its assessments were. For just as the German army had long been less proficient at strategy than at tactics and operations, so German military intelligence provided rather less valuable information about the big strategic picture than it did about tactical and operational level matters such as troop dispositions. The center of German military intelligence's efforts to process and evaluate information concerning the Soviet Union's fighting power was Foreign Armies East, Fremde Heere Ost, or FHO. The FHO was small and under-resourced. It defined East as broadly as could be imagined, with Southeast Europe, Turkey, Iran, the Soviet Union, Scandinavia, and the Far East all covered by just 15 officers. It received information about the Soviet Union from the German military attaché in Moscow, and from the Finns, Estonians, Italians, Romanians, and Japanese, but it suffered from a lack of German agents within high Soviet circles. Nor could the Germans decipher Soviet radio traffic. In any case, Soviet troops on the border regions usually communicated by telephone. Agents generally were extremely difficult to infiltrate across the border because of the Soviets' intense security effort along the frontiers and main transport routes. The Soviet Union was also too large for effective aerial reconnaissance. However, the FHO's commanding officer, Colonel Eberhard Kintzel, could not be bothered with aerial reconnaissance anyway, because producing maps from it would take several weeks. This cavalier attitude typified an officer who, though he was talented and popular, was also too much the optimist and bon viveur. "He was very popular with us," recalled one subordinate, "not just professionally, but also like a carouser in a casino." After the fall of France, the FHO assessed the east from the less than ideally placed location of the château at Fontainebleau, just outside Paris, where Kinsel's joie de vivre seems to have rubbed off on his team. An OKH truck driver saw